super interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, it's like some kind of a little bit sick fascination with it because the country is so isolated that we get almost, as you're saying, the information we're getting is about the nuclear threats and everything goes in this area. Not much like about people who really escaped. There was, it was many, many years ago, so I cannot even put any time frame on that, but there was a case of some North Korean who escaped to the United States, but not escaped. Like he was sent, it was a musician, a pianist or something like that. Mm. And he then asked directly in the United States for asylum. I don't know. I hope I'm not mixing it with another country, but this was like the only thing that came to my mind first Rashid mentioned.
Athens, Greece, and welcome to episode 14 of Fractured Podcast. Here we talk about issues related to refugees in Greece and outside. I have with me the amazing Sonia. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Very early. Good morning for us.
Yes, we look like we're gonna make the sequel for Men in Black.
We do today. Yes. That's
we
true.
We don't have an offer, but we are open for it.
Yeah, and we didn't even synchronize that.
Yeah. So 2 months ago, I was searching about North Korea, so we can have an episode about it. And I came across this amazing organization that's called LINK, short for Liberty in North Korea. And I found out that there are some people helping refugees from North Korea escape. And I was shocked. I was surprised. I was so happy. I was so proud because, as some of you know, in Greece, if you try to help a refugee that's coming from Turkey, you go to jail. So I was so happy that someone is doing the right thing for North Koreans. And today we have with us Sikil Park, who is the South Korea Country Director for Liberty in North Korea. Welcome, Sikil.
Thank you so much, Rashid and Sonia. It's great to be with you.
Amazing.
Sikil, let's start with the basics. And obviously, everybody knows how isolated North Korea is. But just to organize our conversation, can you give us a little bit of an overlook of the situation in North Korea? And I'm actually interested how informed, how aware North Koreans are about their isolation to the rest of the world.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there's so many different aspects that we could talk about North Korea. I think that the top line thing is that the United Nations, through its Commission of Inquiry into North Korean Human Rights, about 10 years ago, actually, already established that there were likely crimes against humanity happening in North Korea, and that the systematic human rights violations in North Korea were without parallel in the modern world. And so basically, any basic right that you can think of is denied and violated to a very serious level in North Korea. North Korean people don't have freedom of movement, not just to leave their own country, but even within their own country, right? North Korean people in the east of the country can't freely travel to the west of the country, from north to south, south to north, etc. North Korean people do not have freedom of information. You know, a lot of the things that we take for granted, being able to call somebody in a different country, being able to use the internet, even North Korean elites are not allowed to use email or, you know, simple internet functions freely. It's the most closed and controlled information environment in the world. There's no free press. There's, of course, no freedom of religion. Religion is, in fact, extremely harshly punished if people are found, you know, to be secretly practicing Christianity, for instance, in North Korea. or other religions as well. So that's the, you know, that's the basic level of freedom and human rights violations in North Korea. It is very isolated. And so the second part of your question is a good one in terms of how much do North Korean people understand about their own situation compared to people in the outside world? And that's something that seems to vary, right? North Korea is a country of 25 million people, and there is some diversity of experience and education and awareness amongst North Koreans. You know, people in Pyongyang are different from people in other parts of the country. People closer to the border with China tend to have a little bit more contact with the outside world and awareness. And so there are some people that are very isolated and have little knowledge about what's going on in the outside world and little ability to be able to compare their own living conditions with, for instance, people living in South Korea or China or, you know, in other countries as well. But increasingly, over the past 20 years or so, more people, especially in the cities, especially younger people, and especially people who kind of have some kind of contact or exposure to the outside world, have been able to learn more facts, more things that the North Korean government tries to deny them. And so this is including through South Korean films and different media that are smuggled into the country on micro SD cards, for instance, SD cards, people using secondhand laptops, mobile phones, consuming media that contradicts the North Korean government's official propaganda and ideologies. And so there are some of these kind of really important ways that North Koreans inside the country can learn about the outside world and can compare their own society to, you know, the possibilities outside of their borders. And this is kind of creating a challenge to the North Korean government's control over the way that people think inside the country.
Some years ago, we saw the Arab Spring in some Arab countries like Tunisia and Egypt and others. And also we saw in Iran after Mahsa Amini's death, people going outside saying, enough, we want this regime out. Did this ever happen in North Korea? If yes, how? And if no, why?
Yeah, again, it's a good question. It's a crucial question. So there have been some disturbances or protests, you could say, in North Korea, but it's probably the country in, you know, in modern human history, you know, going back, you know, into the 20th century as well, that has had the highest level of control over any kind of dissident movement. You know, like you say, we have seen successful movements in other countries. We've seen unsuccessful movements in other countries. But in North Korea, it's been almost non-existent. And that the main thing that I think that shows is the extent to which the North Korean government is effective at having pervasive surveillance across the country and also very effective zero tolerance for any kind of dissident movement. You know, even if people want to, even if people, for instance, you know, as I was talking about before, able to learn things that contradict the government ideologies and, you know, have a different fantasy and, you know, desire for a different future than the North Korean government is offering, it's extremely difficult, almost impossible to organize with other people that might have similar kinds of ideas like we've seen in other countries. And then it's basically impossible to date to create any kind of movement and to have any kind of sustained movement. And that's because it's very easy for the North Korean government to find out about that kind of thing happening within North Korea. And if they do find out, it's not just that those people will be imprisoned like you see in other countries. Basically, they will be executed or completely, you know, and permanently removed from society. And not just them, but their whole families may be punished as well. And so in those kinds of conditions, It basically becomes almost impossible. Even if you really want to be a dissident, the risks are too high and the barriers are too high. And so it becomes almost impossible. Now, that's not to say that there is no form of resistance in North Korea, because there can be different kinds of resistance and disobedience that is not necessarily like an overt external protest movement. For instance, there are conversations that happen between people who may be watching South Korean media together and then have subversive conversations. They may not take that outside, but it's still important that there are conversations amongst families and friends. People exhibit different behaviors, especially after being exposed to and, you know, having learned from, been affected by South Korean media. For instance, people may subtly change the way that they speak and use like a South Korean intonation or South Korean words for some things. It's the same basic language, but there are different, kind of different dialects, different accents. People may change their fashion subtly, or their hairstyle. There are these ways that can kind of, in a lot of cases, fly under the radar. You don't necessarily get, punished in the same way that you would for an explicit protest. But it's a way of signaling to other people that you are engaged in some kind of disobedience and you may have different thoughts than what the North Korean government is saying that you should have. So there are, and there are other forms of protests that happen. There are sometimes single person protests we've seen in North Korea. Like in other countries, there are sometimes suicide protests that happen that we've heard about. There can be anti-government graffiti. So some of these kind of low-level things that you may see in other countries, but just what we don't see is, hundreds or thousands or, of course, tens of thousands of people coming out onto the streets of major cities and demanding change in a kind of very political and explicit way, because it's just so impossible to organize that kind of, political movement, political opposition inside North Korea. You add to that, you don't have some of the tools to stimulate that, including, social media, internet access. There's no free press. There's, it's all even impossible to have kind of underground, a kind of guerrilla journalism and so on. The only thing that exists there is people feeding information out into the outside world. And then sometimes that gets broadcast back in or sent back into North Korea, but a kind of, independent news agency or newspaper or, broadcaster or something like that, just operating within North Korea for other North Korean people is basically unthinkable. So it's very difficult to have a that kind of, explicit protest movement so far in North Korea. However, things could change in the future.
I am interested in your mission, your as Link, and how much support or how much supportive of your mission people in South Korea are, because you as an organization is one thing. The other thing is, are you actually supported, and are you is your mission cheered by the other citizens of South Korea, and is there funding to support this movement?
Yeah, so our organization, just to give some context, so Liberty in North Korea, we have our head office in the United States and we have our, other office here in South Korea. And our staff are, some are from South Korea, some are from North Korea, some are from the States, some are like, Korean diaspora like myself. I have Korean heritage, but I grew up in the UK. And now, of course, I've lived in, here in South Korea for a long time now. So we're kind of from a lot of different places, a lot of people with Korean background. And so, we have staff and we have supporters here in South Korea. More of our support is actually outside of Korea, though. It's more in the English-speaking world so far. And so that's one of the things that we really want to change and build up is the awareness and support for North Korean refugees, North Korean people, and ultimately, you know, positive change and opening in North Korea amongst South Korean people, because I think that there's huge potential here. South Korea is a relatively rich, developed democracy, and there are some groups and activists working here. There are, of course, a significant number of North Korean refugees that have come here. Some of them start their own NGOs or they become activists. And so there's quite a lot that could be done if South Koreans were more interested and stepped up. So we need to try and kind of challenge the way that South Koreans, especially young South Koreans, think about North Korea, trigger more interest and ultimately empathy and support for North Korean people.
I read some stuff about North Korea and I would like to know if they are true or not. First is state-approved haircuts. Is it really true?
Yeah, so basically, yes. Basically, that is true. The North Korean government, even more recently, have been cracking down even more on the influence of foreign media, especially South Korean media. And as I mentioned before, one of the ways that people, especially young North Koreans, are influenced is, you know, it can be in their fashion, it can be in their appearance, their hairstyles, and so on. And so, for instance, people can and do get in trouble for having in the North Korean perspective, it would be like having a too exotic hairstyle. Or for instance, you know, if you dye your hair in North Korea, that would be a big no-no. That would show that you're, you know, very influenced by foreign culture, because basically, you know, Koreans have black hair, right? All Koreans naturally have black hair. And so if you dye your hair, then a lot of South Koreans dye their hair all sorts of colors, you know, lighter brown, blonde even, you know, all sorts of colors, right? Expressing their own individual freedom. In North Korea, it would probably actually be like crazy to dye your hair like to Sonia's hair color, right? To like go full blonde. It just wouldn't happen. Probably you wouldn't even have the access to the stuff, but to dye your hair a little bit, you know, because like not everybody has exactly the same shade of black hair, maybe like slightly, you know, brown for some people. And so some people might, you know, try and push the envelope, like, you know, like young people do everywhere. If there are rules, you kind of come up against the rules and you test where the boundary is, you try and push past that. But that is something which is effectively, you know, policed, and people can get in trouble. You may have to pay a bribe, you may have to serve some kind of punishment for even your hairstyle or your fashion or something like that in North Korea. So they try to maintain a very kind of pure, as in not affected by foreign influence, conservative culture within North Korea.
I think our team here would have a huge problem with it. You don't see the team, but Suda and Ellie have all possible hair colors and they're changing it regularly every month, every 2 months. Rashid actually told me about something really interesting, the three generation of punishment.
Yeah. It just means if one family member is found guilty of a political crime, their parents, children, and even grandchildren can also face imprisonment or exile to forced labor camps. Is that true?
Yes, that is unfortunately true. And that's one of the mechanisms through which the North Korean government maintains, almost zero political dissent inside the country. It's three generations of, you know, that it basically means anybody in your family, right? And depending on the crime, it can be extended horizontally as well. You know, typically people wouldn't really have more than three generations vertically in the family who are, you know, alive at any one point. So basically what it is, you know, anybody related to this person can be punished. for a political crime. This is something which actually has a history in Korean history that goes back, you know, hundreds of years. That sometimes, you know, in the olden days, in the Joseon Dynasty in Korea, that family members could be punished for the crime of one person from the family. So in a way, it's something which is, you know, kind of like been kept from ancient, almost ancient Korean history, or at least, you know, kind of pre-modern, and used today to enforce the, you know, complete kind of political compliance. Because it's one thing, you know, if you're a dissident in another country, you know, even in a highly authoritarian country, if you have different ideas and you want to push your change, if you think that you might put yourself at risk, then some people will do that. Some people with a high risk tolerance, and especially young people, they will do that. And especially if the idea is that, okay, I might get beaten up and I might even have to spend some time in prison. But normally in those countries, you will eventually be released, apart from for the most extreme things. But if the idea is that you will either be executed or sent to prison and never be released, and not just you, but your whole family will be punished in that kind of way. Your whole family might be sent to a political prison camp in North Korea when nobody ever comes back out into society. Then it kind of creates a situation where only somebody who's not thinking rationally would take that level of risk. And not just that, but you know that other people are also thinking about those risks as well. So you know that other, you know, it's not enough to be a dissident by yourself. You need to have the idea that if I speak up and I push for change, that other somebody else is gonna also stand up, and then you can create change from changing more people. But North Korean people understand that if they, even if they did stand up, other people are gonna be thinking about all of those risks, not just to themselves, but to their family as well. And so it's going to make it very, very impossible. And so, for instance, I've heard from North Korean refugees who, when they were still in North Korea, they sometimes actually the North Korean government shows protest movements in South Korea, and they can report them, you know, on the news. And they do that in order to try and show that the South Korean government is illegitimate, and that South Korean people hate their government so much that they're protesting and so on. But I've spoken with people who, when they watched or, you know, saw those kind of scenes in North Korea, they assumed that those South Korean people protesting were basically crazy, because they must have been killed afterwards, and you would have to be crazy to do that. But then after seeing that a few times and thinking about it more, people realized that they must be doing it because actually you can do that. You can do that and get away with it and still live. And maybe even you can create some kind of change in South Korea and other countries. But for themselves, they understand that that's at this point still impossible. And so the three generation, you know, whole family punishment is, you know, a very important mechanism for the North Korean government to maintain control. And in very severe circumstances, I've heard of this applying even to relatives that didn't know that they were related to the person who committed the supposed crime. So that's how far that can go across.
Sakil, I looked at the numbers of the Ministry of Unification when they describe the North Korean defectors, and we see this peak over the last 30 years in 2009, when almost 3,000 people managed to flee North Korea. And then it starts going down, all those numbers, around 2011, so right after Kim Jong-un took over power and he sealed the borders even more. And then it goes down, 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 and then there's COVID. And not only COVID right after, when, of course, like, people couldn't travel between different countries, but North Korea introduced this law that you couldn't even really move between cities. How does it look like right now, if you could reflect on those trends, but also how difficult is it to escape North Korea?
Yeah, so you've identified really important trends there. And unfortunately, the case is that there has been some recovery, but it's probably going to take a while. So as you said, you know, during the Kim Jong-un period, so from basically 2012 onwards, the number had reduced compared to before. And so just before the pandemic, just more than 1,000 North Korean refugees made it to South Korea in 2019. And then it dropped down to, in 2021 and 2022, it was only about 60 people per year in both of those years. And last year, 23, it went back to almost 200 people. So an increase, you know, up from, you know, 60 to, you know, about 60 to about 200. But that's still far behind the level of 1,000 before the pandemic. And it will probably just gradually increase. You know, we hope that it will continue to increase from this point. During the pandemic, the North Korean government locked down its borders probably more than any other country, and for a longer period as well. And part of that was increasing the border security infrastructure as well. So they've built significantly more fencing and more guard posts and these kind of things. And there's been very good analysis on this using satellite imagery, you know, looking at different parts along the border by Human Rights Watch, for instance, and other people that have looked at this closely. We also have heard from our own sources that, you know, border security has increased a lot since the pandemic. And so it's just physically become a lot more difficult for North Koreans to escape from inside the country. The way that people used to escape more was actually north into China. North Korea has three borders. It has the border with China, the border with South Korea, and then on the far northeast, a very short border with Russia. But the border with Russia is almost irrelevant. It's very small. And even if you escape across there, then there's not that much on the Russian side. So it's more about the border with South Korea and China. But the border with South Korea, many people will know, is the most heavily militarized border in the world. Both militaries are, you know, have a huge presence there. There's, you know, minefields across. There's a lot of security and fencing across the whole border between North Korea and South Korea. So almost impossible for North Koreans to escape this way south directly. Sometimes, like last year, some people will come by boat, but that's also extremely difficult as well, probably more difficult than you would imagine to come from North Korea to South Korea by the sea. And so people would used to escape north into China and then have to go all the way through China into Southeast Asia. And then from Southeast Asian countries could resettle in South Korea, or maybe some people would go to the United States or other places. So that's about 5,000 kilometers going north into China and then all the way through China, from the northeast of China to the south, southwest of China into Southeast Asia. It's a very long journey where if you're caught by the Chinese police, then actually they will send you back to North Korea and where you will face interrogation, torture, and punishment for having tried to escape from the country. The Chinese police will also punish people for helping North Korean refugees. And so it was already very difficult, but it's become almost impossible for North Koreans to escape because of the increase in border security during the pandemic. You know, as things in China and other countries normalize a little bit, we will see some more North Korean refugees who are already in China being able to make that journey, but it has become more difficult. It's become more expensive. And so we will, you know, we will hope for and we will work for a gradual increase of the number of people that we can help reach safety and freedom in South Korea. But it's probably not going to be a quick recovery, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for explaining this. We will take a very short break right now. And after the break, we'll discuss more what is happening to people who managed to flee. And during our break, you will hear a little bit more about Link and what they are doing to support North Korean dissidents.
It's been called the Red Box, a mysterious country infamous for its nuclear weapons and dictators. It looks hopeless and unchanging, a ruthless regime ruling through fear and oppression, unlike any other place on the planet. But that North Korea isn't the whole story anymore. And that's because of the North Korean people. They're shaking up the status quo and challenging the regime's control. They know that liberty will not be given. It must be won. And so do we. We're a global movement working with the North Korean people. This movement isn't about high-sounding words. It's about action and momentum. It's about seeing the North Korean people achieve their liberty. Because every refugee we rescue, every North Korean empowered to speak up, and every person who demands freedom for the people means liberty is no longer impossible. It is inevitable. And together, we're one step closer to the day when every man, woman, and child in North Korea is free. Welcome to the movement.
Don't forget to comment, like, and subscribe. Check out the description below to get involved with the movement.
So Kiel, just before the break, you described the routes that North Korean refugees are taking. You described the situation in China, how many people are actually being sent back. I don't know if it's even like a question that has a very specific answer, but how much does it cost actually to leave North Korea? Because I'm assuming people are not doing it just on their own. They need some support of some smugglers to leave.
Yeah, so normally it is through brokers or smugglers. There are some people who manage to escape just by themselves. But, you know, as far as I can tell, it's normally with some kind of help and it's paid for. The amount to escape from inside North Korea to normally China is quite difficult to know because it varies so much from person to person. And especially since the pandemic, it's become almost impossible to escape. So it's difficult to give like a dollar amount for that, for how much it might cost. But in the past, you know, people have talked about, you know, upwards of $10,000 just to escape from inside North Korea, even just to China. And then from China, you have to go, as I described before, from normally Northeast China near North Korea, all the way through China into the south or southwest part of China into you know, Southeast Asian countries. And then sometimes you have to travel through Southeast Asia a little bit. And so that's a very long journey. And that's another cost on top. And some people do that journey almost all in one go. And some people just escape into China. And then they may spend a year there. They may spend 10 years. There are some North Korean women who have been in China for like 20 years or even more than 20 years at this point, before they're able to come through to South Korea. Some people come much more quickly. So that cost of coming through China has also increased a lot since the pandemic, where before the pandemic, you know, it maybe cost around like, you know, $2,000, $3,000, something like that for a North Korean refugee to come through. That would also vary a lot. And, you know, sometimes brokers, if the family in South Korea is paying for, you know, another North Korean person to join them, you know, there's sometimes one North Korean person escapes first to South Korea and then they're bringing more of their families through, just like, you know, sometimes in other refugee situations as well. And in those cases, if it's like individuals, then the brokers may charge twice as much because people don't have that many options. But in any case, that's the kind of level that we were talking about, you know, small thousands of dollars. But now it's more like tens of thousands of dollars. It could be $20,000 just for a North Korean refugee to come out of China and come all the way through, and, you know, into Southeast Asia so they can resettle here in South Korea. So it's almost impossible to do that as a North Korean person by yourself. It means that you need help from an organization like ourselves or from family in, you know, who have come to South Korea first. And even then it's difficult, right, for a North Korean refugee to save up that kind of money. So it would be very difficult, or maybe they're borrowing a lot of money and trying to help people. But that's why so few people have been able to come since the pandemic.
I watched this amazing documentary. It's called North Korea's Most Powerful Woman. It's about Kim Jong-un's sister, Kim Yo-jong, aka the Red Princess. She was not that famous in the beginning. You could see her just in the background after him, holding papers and stuff, this innocent girl. And then slowly, one time she spoke to the parliament, and then one time he sent her to South Korea. It was like the first visit ever. And I'm just wondering about her role and how powerful is she actually?
Well, basically, it's very difficult to know these kind of things in North Korea. You know, it can be difficult even in other, you know, quite closed political systems to know exactly who has so much power. You know, there can be a lot of speculation on that. In North Korea, there's different analysis on that. You know, some people think that she has some power. She is she's from the ruling family. You know, it's almost like a monarchy system in North Korea now, where Kim Il-sung was the first leader, passed the power to his son, Kim Jong-il, who passed the power to his son, Kim Jong-un. And so you're not supposed to have that kind of succession, you know, in a dynasty in a communist or socialist society, right? This is the first time actually that that's ever happened. It actually contradicts the original ideology. I mean, we've seen a somewhat similar thing in Cuba, where the power was passed to, you know, amongst the brothers. But this is very unique in that kind of system, but that's how they've set it up now. And so it does mean that anybody in that family is almost like part of a royal family, and they will have, you know, incredible privilege and, you know, an important position. But it's really speculative about how much power she might have compared to Kim Jong-un. Some of the North Korean defectors that I've spoken with, including people who used to have positions in the North Korean government, they think that she doesn't hold real power. She's more like just a face. Just, you know, she makes statements, and she sometimes makes statements that maybe, you know, other people in the North Korean government wouldn't make, including Kim Jong-un. But some of those more elite North Korean defectors, they often say that that's just actually Kim Jong-un's voice, but using a different face for like a tactical reason. So it could be that, you know, it's difficult to imagine in the North Korean system somebody who is not Kim Jong-un actually having like a lot of power. You know, at the end of the day, it is a one-man dictatorship. You know, he doesn't really have competition for power. It's also not the case that there's no one dictator that can have 100% information and 100% implementation power. And you know, it's not to say that he knows everything and can do everything, but that he doesn't really have like competing power within the system. That would be our understanding of it. And so Kim Yo-jong is kind of an interesting spokesperson. That's how I would see it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I read that most of the people who flee North Korea are women. And this came as a surprise to me, because I can imagine this being an extremely difficult journey. Could you tell us a little bit more about the specific dangers for women on this road?
Yeah, so that is correct. Around 34,000 North Korean refugees have been able to escape and resettle in South Korea. There will, of course, be more North Korean refugees who have escaped and stayed in China, or some who have gone to other countries. But the best data that we have is of the people who have escaped and made it all the way to South Korea. And that's 34,000 people. And around 70%, or just over 70% of them, are female. So actually, the typical, if you like, North Korean refugee is a young North Korean woman. a lot of the people, male and female, are in their 20s and 30s. I mean, I think you see that in, you know, refugee situations and, you know, coming from other parts of the world as well. The reason why 70%, a large majority, are female is because for starters, it can be easier for them to escape from within North Korea. North Korea is a very patriarchal society. In some ways, there's actually more control over men than women. North Korean men, they are more tied to an official workplace in North Korea, whereas women can be, their official status can be like as a housewife, which means that they can actually have a little bit more freedom in some ways. It means that since the 1990s, actually, they may, you know, in a lot of families, they've become the breadwinners. They've become economically, you know, the more important partner, because as a housewife, they have some freedom, and then they can engage in some kind of market activity, make the actual money, whereas the husband, if they're forced to, you know, be tied to an official workplace, then it can be more difficult for them to make money. Now, at the end of the day, actually, a lot of the men, they pay bribes so that they don't have to go to work, and then they can do something which is actually productive. They do some kind of entrepreneurial activity. So North Korea is a rare country in the world where people pay their employer so they don't have to go to work. It's the backwards, you know, it's backwards compared to anywhere else pretty much. So they do that so that they can do this other activity. But again, it can be a little bit easier for women to do that. So there are some factors that, you know, suggest that maybe they have a little bit more freedom. Maybe they may have a little bit more motivation to leave as well. One interesting thing, this may not be a huge factor, but one interesting factor may actually be the influence of South Korean media, that some of that, you know, a lot of it is the kind of K-dramas that historically tends to be more popular and interesting and engaging and so on for female audiences. And that's the same in North Korea as well. So North Korean women may have been more influenced by South Korean media, may have more fantasies about the outside world and so on from South Korean media. So there may be a bit of a kind of pull factor, if you like, from the effect of foreign media, especially South Korean media. But then actually probably the bigger factor, and it's unfortunately a very tragic factor, is that sex trafficking is a huge factor in North Koreans escaping, especially going to China, where there is a market, if you like, there is a demand for North Korean women to be sold into forced marriages to Chinese men, especially in rural areas of Northeast China, where there is a lack of women to marry, basically, and also being sold into different kinds of sex work, both, you know, in brothels and offline sex work and online sex work as well, where there can be very terrible situations where North Korean women are kept in apartments. They're essentially, you know, locked in apartments, and they have to do this kind of work, you know, day in, day out, selling their bodies, if you like, online. But of course, they're not, you know, receiving the money for that. So it's kind of like online sexual slavery. And so North Korean women are very vulnerable to those kinds of situations in China. That means that, you know, North Korean women initially are more likely to escape or be brought across and go into China. But it also means that some of them are able to come to South Korea. So compared to North Korean men, North Korean women have a bit more of a chance of escaping and going into China. And then because there's more North Korean women in China than North Korean men in China, for some of those people who are able to make it through, they come, so there's more arrivals are female. And that's the same for our organization as well. Liberty in North Korea has been able to help more than 1,250 North Korean refugees to make that journey through China and Southeast Asia to safety in South Korea, and some people going to the United States so far. And for us as well, it's mostly young women, and unfortunately, a significant number of them, not all of them, but a significant number have been trafficked or, you know, have been sold into a kind of forced marriage in China. Sometimes they have children then in China as well. They may have a child with the, you know, the kind of husband that they were living with in China. Sometimes they are able to bring them with them to South Korea. Sometimes they have to leave them in China and then try and bring them later on. And so there's a lot of tragic family situations that results from this, these kind of vulnerabilities as well.
I'm assuming that those women who are stuck in China, whether in this forced marriage or forced sex labor situation, they are completely under the radar, right? They live without any documents, probably they are not reported, and we do not have any really credible numbers on how many people stay in China and never reach South Korea.
Exactly. They are undocumented. They are under the radar. There's, you know, probably thousands, maybe tens of thousands of North Korean women in that situation. But precisely because they are undocumented and hidden, and it's very difficult for anybody to, you know, kind of research and do a survey or find out how many people are there. But that's also actually the reason why they are so vulnerable to these kinds of exploitation, right? The fact that they don't have documentation means that if they are caught by the Chinese police, then they may be sent back to North Korea. And that might be even worse than living in China and being exploited. And so that's the situation that many North Korean women face, that they may be exploited in these terrible ways. They may face domestic abuse. They may face, you know, sexual exploitation. But they can't go to the Chinese police, because if they go to the Chinese police, they will be arrested as an illegal North Korean migrant and then potentially be sent back to North Korea, where they will be interrogated, tortured, and maybe face very harsh punishment.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
Speaking of North Korean women, have you seen this video of Kim Jong-un cries as he requests North Korean women to have more babies? He was crying. He's like, guys, I wanted to make more baby. I was like, what? I would like to know your comment, because for me, he just looks like he needs more soldiers. He needs more slaves. And it just looks to me as a baby crying for more toys. But I want to know your comments about this.
Yeah. You know, Kim Jong-un, he's been much more public than his father. And you know, it's clear that he makes a lot of effort in the kind of propaganda department. He talks about, you know, if of course, you know, talks about the kind of classic propaganda and, you know, talks about military threats and these kind of things. But he also does sometimes talk about problems as well. And that's interesting. You know, he talks about the problem of corruption in North Korea. He's talked about the economic and food problems in North Korea. You know, one way of seeing that is that as North Korean people learn more about the outside world and can compare their own situation to that of people in China and that of people in South Korea, they understand more about their own problems compared to other people. And there may be an increase in kind of dissatisfaction or complaints and this kind of stuff. And so Kim Jong-un has to know about and react to that. And one way of doing it is to at least recognize the problem and, you know, say that you're going to work on it, you know, make some promises, you know, show the people that you're sensitive to their situation, even though ultimately he's not actually allowing the situation to improve in a serious or significant way. And so we can see, you know, some of these kind of things, and including, you know, his displays of emotion as, you know, a reaction, you know, his and his own propaganda style, his own PR style. And in a way, maybe adaptation to how North Korean society and North Korean people have changed, and this creating some pressure for some kind of changes. Now, it's still not enough, and we still need to see so much more change. But this is actually one of the reasons why our organization and, you know, the North Koreans that we work with think that it's so important to get more information, news, media, education, and so on into the North Korean people, for North Korean people inside the country to be able to communicate with the outside world, to be able to access information so that they don't have to only know what Kim Jong-un and the North Korean government is telling them, but they can actually know for themselves, you know, different realities, compare the outside world to their own country, understand that the abuse of power and human rights violations and corruption and exploitation of North Korean government officials is not normal, is not something that you just have to expect in the world, but that actually North Korea is the worst country for that, and that on top of that, other people in other countries are so much more prosperous, they have so much more opportunity, they have so much more freedom. And so to increase the aspiration and challenge the North Korean government's ideologies and narratives about these kind of things, the North Korean government's official analysis for where these problems come from. Because ultimately, the problems of the North Korean people are being caused, generated by the North Korean government itself, but they, of course, blame everything else. So we have to be able to, you know, help North Korean people to get access to the information that can challenge that so that they can think for themselves. They can, you know, talk amongst other North Korean people. And ultimately, there can be a growing force for change in North Korea that Kim Jong-un and the North Korean government has to deal with. Because if the North Korean government can control information, then it makes it much easier for them to control people and just keep them poor and oppressed.
So, Kil, I want to ask you about the situation of people who fled already to South Korea. Are they anyhow verified by the South Korean government? What is the situation there? We are here in Europe, used to a very, very long verification process. There are many rejections. Do rejections even happen in South Korea? Are people sent back? Or what is the situation there?
Yeah, so I think that it is very different in terms of verification. So actually, because we help North Korean refugees to come through that journey, we do some verification for ourselves because we need to make sure that people are, you know, as far as we can tell, genuine North Korean refugees and also are not going to be a threat to other North Korean refugees. You know, we need to make sure that it's not, for instance, actually an agent of the North Korean government who is trying to expose those networks that are helping North Korean refugees to come to South Korea. So there's some verification on our end, but the South Korean government obviously has so much more capacity to do verification and investigation with North Korean refugees to check their story, to check their identity. When North Korean refugees arrive in South Korea, they are taken to the National Intelligence Service facility. So it's basically like the equivalent of the CIA. It's like the CIA and the FBI put together actually in South Korea. And they typically spend up to 3 months there. So they're not living in South Korean society. They are kept in this center. And they, you know, there's questioning, there's debrief. There's also actually, you know, a kind of, investigation to try and see if these North Korean defectors have any useful or valuable information for the South Korean government about North Korean, you know, military or, you know, something that the South Korean government and the South Korean intel side especially would want to find out about. So there is this, you know, background check and intelligence debrief, and through that they establish whether they are a genuine North Korean refugee, That tends to be, you know, somewhat easy. It's very difficult for somebody who's not from North Korea to persuade the South Korean government that they are from North Korea. You know, for instance, it could be a Chinese Korean person who is as Korean ethnicity but only lived in China. But it would be quite difficult for them, you know, to describe a convincing life story and to be able to answer all of the questions that the South Korean government would be able to ask of them. And now that the South Korean government has done this through tens of thousands of North Korean refugees, they of course have, like, you know, a good data set to cross-check different details in people's stories and so on. And so I think that they probably, you know, they have quite an efficient way of checking if somebody is genuinely from North Korea and they're genuinely a North Korean refugee. The difficulty would be if they were a North Korean agent posing as a North Korean refugee to then try and come to South Korea as a spy, if you like. That's probably not that common though, actually. There are other ways for, you know, North Korean agents to try and come to South Korea. It's probably not the easiest way. I'm not aware actually of, you know, people being, you know, caught and rejected through that process. It may happen, you know, without that being publicized, of course. So a repatriation from South Korea to North Korea is extremely rare and almost unthinkable. The reason why I say almost unthinkable is because actually during the previous government under President Moon Jae-in, there were two North Korean fishermen who ended up in South Korea, and they actually stated their desire to stay in South Korea, but there were allegations of basically murders committed by these fishermen against other fishermen, and the North Korean government demanded that these people would be sent back to North Korea, and the South Korean government was trying to negotiate with the North Korean government at the time. And so unfortunately, I think, you know, from my perspective, it's unfortunate that they very quickly complied with that request from the North Korean side and forcibly sent these two North Koreans back to North Korea, where presumably they would face torture and harsh punishment. And so according to international law, the South Korean government should not have done that. There should have been at least, you know, some kind of due process. But it's a very rare instance where that kind of thing happened. And in the vast majority of cases, North Korean refugees are accepted and given South Korean nationality actually very quickly after they are established as genuine North Korean refugees.
Mm-hmm. So, Gil, a quotation from your page. Imagine getting into a time machine and going 60 years into the future. That's what North Korean refugees say when it first arrives in South Korea. So my question is about this resettlement program. Like, how does it work for them? What are the difficulties? How are you as an organization supporting this?
Yeah. So that's something that I've heard from many North Korean refugees, that it can be like coming out of a time machine into the future. You know, South Korea has changed so much over the last 50 years. You know, it's not that long ago. It's about that period when South Korea was actually one of the poorest countries in the world. South Korea was a dictatorship. Over that period, South Korea has developed to, you know, now the GDP is, you know, similar to a European country. It's a robust democracy. It's a very globalized society as well. A lot of international influence. And also South Korea is now, of course, you know, part of international influence, you know, spreading its culture to other countries as well. And so for a North Korean, especially from a North Korean province, many North Korean refugees come from the northeast parts of North Korea, to come to South Korea, it's the same base, you know, culture. It's, you know, people are Korean in North Korea and Korean in South Korea. It's the same base language. It's a little bit like the difference between American English and British English, for instance. It's a different accent. There's some different vocabulary, but it's understandable in the most part. But there's so many new things in South Korea that people are unfamiliar with. You know, most North Korean people, when they escape, they've never drunk coffee, for instance. You come to South Korea, you have to drink coffee. Coffee shops are everywhere. It's where young people hang out. There's more Starbucks in Seoul than in New York.
What?
You know, really? And so North Korean refugees come to Seoul, and you know, the coffee shop is a microcosm, right? Because you walk in and all of the words are in South Korea as well. We just say like cappuccino and macchiato and latte and Americano and all of these things. And a North Korean person who's just arrived here looks at it and it's all like a alien language. And so there are these kind of things that they have to catch up with. Like if you were suddenly in like a sci-fi film, right? You have to learn these new words, these new technologies, these new ways that people are, you know, doing things and so on. A lot of the base things are similar, but there are these things, you know, built on top of that with the, you know, more modern technology and so on. And so as younger people, they learn those kind of things pretty quickly. People who are older, you know, maybe they brought their children to South Korea, you know, more middle-aged, it can be more difficult to pick up, you know, the new language and, you know, new skills and these kind of things. So there's a lot of difference between different people, especially at the, you know, depending on what age they're at and what education they may be coming with and so on. So our programs are basically designed to help them kind of land on their feet to start off with, help them in the first year of their resettlement. And then in the more long term, especially now that not so many North Korean refugees are actually arriving in South Korea, we're focused a little bit more long term on educational programs, including, for instance, helping North Korean refugees to learn English, which is very important for education and professional success. And of course, gaining access to, you know, global communication and global opportunities with the English language. And then also we provide scholarships and some other programs to try and empower especially young North Korean refugees to make the most of their potential in their new societies.
My last official question, because to be honest, I have 20 more questions, but I'm not allowed to ask them. So what do you say to people who want to help North Koreans? How can the world help North Koreans, not only as government, but as people? Because I believe that each one of us can help, even in a small amount of.
For sure. It's very important, of course, you know, and there are things that we can do. You know, first of all, I would say thank you. I want to thank you guys as well, Rashid and Sonia, and Refocus for bringing some attention to this issue. I think that often people hear about North Korea, but it's just Kim Jong-un and nuclear weapons and missiles. So it's very important for us to have some interest in North Korean people. And so, you know, as somebody who, you know, cares a lot about this issue and works with a lot of North Korean people, I would say thank you to anybody who's interested and wants to help. And I think that the ways that anybody can help is, first of all, to challenge the narrative on North Korea, which is so focused on Kim Jong-un and nuclear weapons, and learn more about North Korean people. And so, you know, this can be approached in different ways, but especially learning directly from North Korean refugees, North Korean people who have the lived experience of living in North Korea. Some North Korean refugees have written really good books and memoirs about their life in North Korea. That's really interesting. Some people have made, you know, or contributed to documentaries. We've created that kind of content with North Korean refugees as well. Some North Korean people have started YouTube channels or have started to become spokespeople. So listening to North Korean people, hearing their stories, and then actually also amplifying that as well, you know, sharing North Korean people's voices and stories with other people. If people, you know, if North Korea is in the news or if people might be interested, you know, sharing that through social networks and also just, you know, with our friends and families, in order to elevate North Korean people up to the level of the other things that we look at in North Korea, you know, again, being Kim Jong-un and nuclear weapons and so on. And then the other thing, of course, is that there are organizations, including ourselves, Liberty North Korea, and some other organizations, especially based here in South Korea, that are working to help North Korean refugees, that are working with North Korean refugees to get more information into North Korean people inside the country, that are working to advocate for bigger change on this issue. But unfortunately, there's a real lack of support for these kinds of organizations, you know, operating here in South Korea and, you know, somewhat around the world as well. And so if anybody has any kind of, you know, spare, even a small amount of money per month, that's really important, you know, and I also try to support some other organizations that are helping other refugees in South Korea and North Korean refugees, other organizations, because I know from working in this kind of organization that the regular donation of, for instance, you know, $5 or $10 per month is crucial for organizations to be able to continue that kind of activism and support for other refugees who are still coming, or to create programs to try and change North Korea from the inside and so on. So that's the other way that people can support. Even if it's a small amount per month, the number of people doing that growing is really crucial. And that's one of the most important, real tangible ways that people can show that they support North Korean people and that they are an ally and in solidarity for North Korean people who face some of the most difficult human rights violations in the world. So maybe if it's okay with you guys, I can share some links so that people can learn more, learn directly from North Korean people and find ways that they can contribute in the show notes to this episode.
Of course. Yeah.
Absolutely. We'll be very happy to share those links. We always add something to the notes of the podcast. But I wanted to highlight what you said about those small donations. We always say, like, how about you give us your one coffee a month? Which means, like, you know, if you live in New York, your espresso is probably something like $5, right? So how about, like, you know, one espresso a month for Refocus? And we would very much encourage everybody to support Liberty in North Korea, because you just put a lot of light on the situation of refugees in North Korea. But if we can take at least a tiny action right after listening to this podcast, I would encourage people to also check your YouTube channel, because it is something that you wouldn't expect it to be. It's pretty positive. There are those funny videos of, like, North Korean word of the day and explanation about culture. And it's a great source of learning within, like, few minutes. Those are short videos. So we will put a link to your YouTube video as well.
The way that anybody can find our content online, of course, is if you just also Google Liberty in North Korea or search in YouTube for Liberty in North Korea, then you'll find us right away.
Thank you very much, Sokil, for being with us. Sokil, one more time to remind everybody, represents Liberty in North Korea. Link, very easy to remember for anybody who wants to check online. Thank you very much to our team here in the studio, Sude, Eli, Davud, Doug, Rashid. Refocus Media Labs produces this podcast, and this podcast is powered by Aperture. Thank you very much for those amazing lights that you guys sent us. Fractured will be back in 2 weeks' time. We will cover another topic related to the refugee crisis and people on the move. And till then, please educate yourself, read more, inform others about the situation of refugees. And if you have any requests about the next topics, we will be very happy to cover them. So write us. You will have all the information in the show notes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We should introduce this system next time somebody is late for a significant amount of time. You didn't work, so you pay us for your working time.
What if someone is always on time? Can I get...
You're getting a normal salary for that.
What? I'm doing my best to wake up early.
What if you're too early?
If I come 1 hour early? 8 hours early.
I don't care.
1 hour 8 hours early. You pay me double.